This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The action in Torino and environs this week has featured several accidents, some stunning surprises, and the introduction of a new Olympic sport absolutely certain to pop the knees of most of the next generation of youth worldwide, or at least winter worldwide. Joining me to discuss that excellent source of adventure and, in at least one case, gold for the U.S. is the Boston Globe's John Powers. John, welcome back to the program.
Bill, how are you?
Very well, thank you. I guess we should start with two major disappointments for the U.S. squad. On Friday, the inability of snowboarder Lindsay Jacob Ellis to maintain an apparently insurmountable lead in the snowboard cross finals, and the surprising sudden inability of the women's hockey team to play gold or even silver medal caliber hockey. What happened?
Well, I think Lindsay Jacob Ellis was just astounding. I mean, there appeared she was so far ahead on the snowboard cross that short of the mountain opening her up and swallowing her, it was impossible. She tried a little hot dog move, completely unnecessary, but, you know, in the sport, we like style. And the next thing you know, there is the gold medal. I think the women's hockey team was even more baffling. They had never lost to the Swedes. Mm-hmm. They were ahead 2-0 in this game. It looked like going straight to the final, and the next thing you know, they're losing a shootout.
I know you're an ice person, being as you are in Torino, but I can't help asking if that snowboard cross isn't the gnarliest, awesomest sport in the universe, unless you're Lindsay Jacob Ellis.
Well, everyone seems to love it, because there are most sports here, people have some concept of understanding. No one understands this, and we think maybe more sports should be like this. We were saying you should have four ice dance couples out there at the same time and just let it be elbow-to-elbow combat.
Seth Westcott was, of course, the American who did win a gold medal in the snowboard cross, and his career, I gather, is launched.
Absolutely. I think one of the amazing things here is that we thought these would be the X Games, as in X Games, and what we're seeing is most of the medals are coming from those places. If you look at the snowboarders, dude, I mean, the half-pipers are just awesome. They're getting insane air.
John, you've got the jargon down. I'm very, very impressed.
I feel like I am an adolescent again. But you know what's interesting? The most bizarre thing of all happens at ice dancing. And I realize that, you know, it's a contradiction. Everything is always bizarre. But an Italian dance couple, which had not competed in 4 years, shows up and is in first place after the compulsory.
So Italy really has something to cheer about in that.
Oh, yes. Well, see, this was the thing. Barbara Fusar-Poli and Maurizio Margaglio were world champions the year before the last Olympics. Didn't do well there. We're going to call it a career. Now the games are in Italy, and they say, you know, we've never skated really in Italy in front of our own fans for a big prize. So they decide, hey, why not? They get back into shape this year. They come out here. They don't know what the system is. They don't know what all these numbers are. They sit and they look up on the scoreboard and they say, what does 39.525 mean? And suddenly they're in first.
Excellent.
As the Russians said, very strange. The Russians don't quite know what to make of this.
John, I want to return to the hockey picture for just a moment. Canada-Sweden in the women's hockey finals. Can the Swedes be on such a run that they actually win this thing?
Well, I'm not sure what the word miracle on ice means in Swedish, but certainly they have a very strong goalie, and I think that is the key thing here. You saw what happened to the Czechs when Hasek went down with a leg injury, and I think that the Americans knew about this girl and just couldn't put a puck by her. The Canadians, however, are very strong. I mean, that would be the upset of all upsets if they could take both teams down. But at least now they will get a medal. It'll be no worse than a silver, which is certainly, this is good for women's hockey. Because people were saying, you know, you've only got two teams in the world that can really play. Why do we do this? And now we know.
Speaking of Canada, which you alluded to a moment ago, the controversy surrounding Wayne Gretzky after the Rick Tocchet gambling scandal broke has apparently abated. So, good thing for both teams, Canada.
Absolutely. I think the first thing that Wayne did when he got here, he said, I said I wasn't involved, and that hasn't changed, and let's talk about something else. I mean, this is a big story, certainly, back in the States. It's big with the Canadian media here, but I think it was also big because the Canadian team wasn't playing yet. Now they are. Both of the teams are on a real roll. It looks like they could go double gold again here. So I think, at least for the time being, that story isn't happening here.
I want to get your take on the story of the 32-year-old Austrian downhiller Michaela Dorfmeister, who narrowly missed a gold medal in 2002 in Salt Lake, but who captured one this time around, conveniently just before her retirement. That's my favorite individual story. What's your favorite?
I like that one, too. And you know what is great about this? It is slippery out there, as they say.
Snow is slippery.
It is such a random event. And so often you see the athletes trying to come back, waiting 4 years to get what they couldn't get before. And if you look at what the huge disappointment that the Austrians had on the men's downhill, they had that thing locked up, and an unknown Frenchman comes in and takes it. Mm-hmm. So this, in a little bit, was this kind of karmic payback for Austria, which owns the downhill, and even better for her. That is the most unpredictable event of all in Alpine, and to wait 4 years and get it done is just the best story so far of the Games.
John, the women's figure skating begins on Tuesday with a short program. In an Olympics where surprises have been so numerous, is there any point in even talking about a favorite?
Well, it's interesting. People now will say that, you know, it ought to be the world champion, Irina Slutskaya, but no 27-year-old has won this thing since Madge Sayers back in 1908. We aren't even quite sure how old she was. What is interesting now, Michelle Kwan out, the pressure is going to be on Sasha Cohen, who seems to have gone in the bubble here. She's practicing behind closed doors. She's not giving interviews. So if there is a dark horse you want to put your money on, if that's allowed in figure skating, Kimmy Meissner, the girl from Baltimore, who was a leaper. She landed the first triple axel since Tonya Harding. And she is loose. She says the Olympics are just like one big sleepover.
U.S. figure skater Johnny Weir failed to medal. Can we blame that on the new scoring system or maybe the color of the gelato stands in and around Torino? What is it?
Some people were blaming it on the bus. Johnny misread the bus schedule and was stranded out there until he jumped into a car and arrived about an hour before he skated. He said that wasn't really a good excuse, but I think what happened is he looked up at the big bright lights and said, oh my gosh, it's the Olympics. I think what you've been seeing a lot of, especially with the U.S. skaters, is they're not quite ready for prime time. Evan Lysacek would have won a medal here. Had a terrible short program, came back, and ended up fourth. But I think this is a team that really needs more sports psychologists than it does choreographers.
John Powers covers the Olympics for the Boston Globe, and each Olympiad he joins me from exotic cities from around the world. Thank you, John.
Buenos Aires, Bill.
If you can identify that sound, perhaps you know entirely too much about speed skating. It's the rat-a-tat-tatting of the epoxy fingertips on the left-hand glove a speed skater wears. In this case, rat-a-tat-tatting against the boards along the rink at Iorio Arena in Walpole, Massachusetts. The hard tips can glide along the ice with no drag when the speed skater gets almost parallel to the sheet during the turns. Those particular clackety tips are decorated with Venezuelan flags. They belong to 32-year-old Jose Ardila of the Boston Speed Skating Club. He began speed skating 8 years ago and has had the chance to meet several Olympians, which may account for an ambition he once harbored.
I didn't get really fast, but I got fast enough that I could probably compete for Venezuela.
Yeah, because what the heck? Speed skating is not exactly, your sport of choice down
there. And as far as I know, there's no Venezuelan speed skater, so I would have been the only one.
So what derailed you? It sounds to me like a perfectly good ambition.
Red tape, actually. That's what held me back. And then it got to the point that I was really older than I should have been because I was out of my prime, I guess.
In part for the surprising lack of an efficient Venezuelan speed skating federation, Jose Ardila has had to be content with training with Olympians rather than becoming one. The Boston Skating Club has sent at least one athlete to the Olympics since the 88 Games, and this winter is no exception. 25-year-old Caroline Hallisey, who is competing on the U.S. ladies' 3,000-meter relay team that advanced on Sunday to the finals, could hardly have avoided the sport. According to her father, whom I spoke with recently at the same Boston Skating Club session where I encountered those clackety fingertips, Caroline was skating nearly as soon as she could walk.
Got a pair of old figure skates, old Rydell thing figure skates, white ones. Found them, what size they were, could have been like a one or two. I got to make them speed skates. I can't afford speed skates, so I took them to a grinding wheel. I ground off the tips, took her out in the ice and held her between my legs. Did that for about 4 months. She took off by herself.
Caroline Hallisey made her first Olympic team in 1998, then returned to the Games in 2002. According to her father, the current trip is the most promising.
I think the U.S. relay team has a really good shot on medaling. I can't say they're going to do a gold medal or silver medal, but I say they have a legit shot for a bronze, if not silver. I think it's the best relay team they put out since they started doing the sport.
According to Steve Hallisey, a medal would be welcome in the household for various reasons, one of which has to do with the way speed skaters find sponsors and other means of financial support.
We're sure not making a living at it. It's only there for persons who have a medal. They pretty much absorb up all the sponsorship, and when the other skaters ask for the money, let's say, what have you done lately? And they might just be 1/10 of a second off, but they will not get the money, so it's really tough.
Caroline Hallisey's website instructs potentially helpful fans regarding the mechanics and benefits of sponsorship, though she said just before leaving for Italy that even the most generous corporation wouldn't be able to put a patch on the uniform that she's wearing at these games.
Unfortunately, it wouldn't be able to be put on my skin suit for the Olympics, strictly because we're not allowed to advertise at the Olympics for any sponsorship. But for anyone that's interested for stuff after the games or just in general, anything that I might be doing, I can plaster you all over my suit, hats, jackets, anything that you guys want.
It would make a nice ending to a story that begins with a loving dad who likes speed skating, chopping down some secondhand figure skates for his daughter, if Caroline Hallisey were to win a medal. But according to Caroline, the sport she began pursuing when her parents brought her speed skating because it was easier than finding a babysitter has already paid off.
It would be great to come back with a medal, but the whole experience of going to the Olympics is probably the biggest part for me. You know, we've come close to getting the medal. I came close in Salt Lake, and I think we have another good chance in Torino. And we'll definitely be trying to bring something back home with us. We'll just have to see how things go.
The finals of the ladies' 3,000-meter relay will be contested on Wednesday. The U.S. team was the third fastest behind China and Canada in qualifying for the finals. It's 19 minutes. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Las Vegas rolls the dice in its quest for a pro sports team. But first, joining me on the line from Houston to discuss the NBA on the occasion of the All-Star break, which, coincidentally, is in the Bayou City, is Jonathan Fagan of the Houston Chronicle. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
All-Star games in general can be anticlimactic, but the NBA All-Star game seems positively riveting, coming as it does on the heels of the NFL's Pro Bowl. Nice bit of scheduling for the basketball guys, huh?
It is. It's a different sort of thing than all the other All-Star games in that it is sort of just a party. And the NFL one seems to have no purpose at all. The baseball one is sort of for the baseball romantics, and it's good in that way, very good in that way. Hockey just is lost in terms of its All-Star game. It sort of has no stamp in the culture, I don't think. Basketball, it really is a three-day party in that city. The entire city becomes overtaken by the events. It does become anticlimactic at the end of that weekend because so much happens all over town. I mean, it's just a mind-boggling thing. And I've said this for years, and I've told people in Houston this. Every year, with the possible exception of the season that it was in Los Angeles, we all go to town, this whole massive event happens. Everybody talks before it's going to happen that you don't know what's coming. You really don't understand how big this is. And they always say, yes, we do. We've done our research. We know. And then the whole circus leaves town, and they say, you know, we really didn't know how big it was going to be. And I'm sure it's going to happen with Houston, too.
How would you characterize Houston as a sports destination? They did host the game once before in 89.
Yeah, and that's in basketball terms and NBA terms, that might as well be 1889. It's just nothing to do with what event is about to hit Houston. But Houston does know how to do this. In the last few years, there's Super Bowl, World Series, Baseball All-Star Game, and now NBA All-Star Game. And so the city does know how to put on one of these things. Because of the construction in downtown, Obviously, the baseball stadium won't have much to do with this, but building a baseball stadium made it possible for the baseball All-Star Game. Building the football stadium made it possible for the Super Bowl. And building a new basketball arena, kind of one of the new state-of-the-art arenas, right next door to a massive convention center, makes it ideal for this event. It's a city that's well-equipped for handling this. We'll still be overrun, and when it's over, we'll say we didn't know what was coming.
Now, is your opinion shared by the players? Has there been grumbling amongst the All-Stars that they peaked during a year when the game is being held in Houston rather than, say, Las Vegas, which is next year's host city?
Actually, Houston, among professional athletes and NBA players, is an extremely popular city. There's a tremendous number of athletes that live in the Houston area that have never played for Houston teams and are not from Texas or Houston. It sort of has all the advantages of a big city without being as difficult as some of the cities on the coasts. And then to people who make that kind of money, having no state income tax, and that it's in the middle of the country. And so these guys in their off-season travel a good deal. It's somewhat easier to be in a central time zone. It's an immensely popular city to professional athletes, and particularly NBA players. And so this one is, among the players, been one that's been anticipated for quite a while.
All right, my pick for a final score is West 198, East 187. What do you think?
Sounds like a good game. Might not be quite that much, but, you know, there's not a lot of defense played. It's not intense enough for them. You know, if they played absolutely zero defense, as your score might indicate, they still couldn't score that much because they're not intense enough offensively. But, you know, I think there's no reason that it can't get to the 117, 120, 122 area. And people like that. I would like it to be just a little bit more serious than last year, where, and you get this every year, where everybody defers so much in the beginning that it's, you know, no, you take it. And, no, let me set a pass to you. Let me take care. You know, that really isn't the way it's supposed to be. A lot of basketball is beat the guy in front of you. And then that eventually happens when the game gets competitive. Last year it really never happened. I would like to see someone, you know, decide, you know, I'm going to put my stamp. Because there are some All-Star games that are touchstones in Magic Johnson's career, Isaiah Thomas's, Michael Jordan's. You know, it would be wonderful if LeBron James or Kobe Bryant said, you know, this is going to be my game. I'm going to make this part of my legacy. And then other people would be forced to step up and try and stop that, or to make it, you know, get just something that sends some electricity into the competitive juices that these guys all have. That's the one thing the game always needs and doesn't often have. So I'm kind of hoping for someone to want to see, put his own stamp on it, and we'll see what we get.
Jonathan Fagan is a columnist for the Houston Chronicle. Jonathan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's a pleasure.
Enough of the 2006 NBA All-Star Game. Let's jump ahead to 2007, when the big guys in long shorts will jet to Las Vegas to dribble, dunk, and double down. That spectacle is sure to feature glitz, glamour, and maybe even a showgirl or two. And as Only a Game's Karen Given reports, authorities in Las Vegas hope the All-Star Game will open the door to Major League Sports in Sin City.
In front, Quad Bypass, second with Tubbs Power and Dan Ritter.
At the Las Vegas Hilton Race and Sports Superbook, Jay Cornegay will take your bet on horse races from coast to coast. He'll take your bet on this summer's World Cup in Germany. But he won't take your bet on the 2007 All-Star Game in Las Vegas. That's the agreement sportsbook directors like Cornegay made in order to bring the NBA to town.
It wasn't a very difficult decision because it's an NBA All-Star Game. Even though we'd love to take wagers on it, it's not a huge wagering event. For one game, an NBA All-Star Game, it's not a problem.
In addition to negotiating the wagering ban, the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority presented the NBA with an all-star bid worth $4.7 million. LVCVA Chief Executive Rossi Rollincotter says with ticket sales and other income, the game will cost the authority $2.5 million. And he says it's worth it.
There'll be about 25,000 people will come in during All-Star Week. The non-gaming economic impact for that group is about $27 million. And then we've estimated close to a half billion media impressions during the course of All-Star Week, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. And that's a growth market for us in the future.
Already home to minor league football and hockey, as well as fringe sports like ultimate fighting and bull riding, attracting a major league team is the dream of Las Vegas Mayor Oscar Goodman. Mayor Goodman wasn't available for comment, but he recently told USA Today, "To be a great American city, you have to have sports." And Rollincotter believes Las Vegas can be a great American city.
In fact, we've had, you know, a variety of teams and leagues, you know, look at Las Vegas. As the marketplace continues to increase, the media market gets larger, the population base gets larger. I don't think it's a matter of if it will happen. I think it is a matter of when it will happen.
But last week's NHL gambling scandal highlights the complicated relationship between Major League Sports and the only state in the nation with legal sports books. The NFL has rejected Las Vegas tourism commercials during the Super Bowl, but Mayor Goodman once offered to build a brand new stadium to host Monday night football games. NBA Commissioner David Stern is on the record opposing betting on sports of any kind, but Las Vegas hosted 11 home games for the Utah Jazz during the 1983-84 season. Major League Baseball banned Pete Rose for betting on sports, but Las Vegas had been considered as a new home for the Montreal Expos and, more recently, the Florida Marlins. Miami Herald sports columnist Dan LePetard says the leagues have plenty of reasons to listen when Las Vegas comes calling.
Las Vegas is money. That's what you associate with Las Vegas. Now, the question is Major League Baseball or is the professional sports franchise desperate and greedy enough to take that money at any cost? They're listening and they're welcoming Las Vegas at every turn, but if they build them a shiny new stadium made of gold, they're overpaying for something that they have to overpay for because of some of the things that they have to overcome.
Mayor Goodman has suggested that to lure the major leagues, the city's sports books might agree to ban betting on the home team. But Bob Scucci, race and sportsbook manager at the Stardust, isn't sure that's a good idea.
It puts us on a slippery slope. If we start making concessions like that, then the next concession will be NFL football, and then the next concession will be college sports, and then it snowballs, and it's long-term bad for the industry. There's this myth that somehow, because a game is being played in Las Vegas, that somehow the integrity of the game is being compromised, and nothing could be further from the truth. You know, UNLV has been playing here for decades, and we've never seen anything that looked like there was a bit of impropriety.
Of course, between 1960 and 2001, Nevada sports books weren't allowed to take bets on UNLV or the University of Nevada. But gambling expert and UNLV professor Bill Thompson says there's another reason sports betting scandals tend to happen outside the state of Nevada.
Vegas turns in the crooks. Crooked gambling, if it is permitted in Las Vegas, would destroy Las Vegas. But a dirty deal, a crooked game, a blackjack dealt from the bottom of the deck, people would not come here. We would not get 38 million visitors here.
Professor Thompson also believes that no professional athlete would jeopardize a multi-million dollar salary by betting on his team. But Tom Gray, executive director of the National Coalition Against Gambling Expansion, doesn't buy any of these arguments.
What happens is you can be extorted. All you have to do is get someone where they owe someone, and I don't care how many million dollars you've made, we're talking about high rollers that bet multi-million dollars. So the saw that these are rich athletes and they won't get caught in compromising positions vis-a-vis betting, I think, is naive, and those that make the argument just don't know the psychology of what happens to a pathological gambler.
As for the idea that casinos would willingly give up revenue to pave the way for a major league team, Tom Gray doesn't put much stock in that either.
Casinos, what's theirs is theirs and what's yours is negotiable. So to think that they're going to give up any of their money, I think is, if you're a betting person, don't bet on it.
Mayor Goodman might have an even bigger obstacle to his major league dreams. Las Vegas isn't known as a sports town, and teams, with the exception of UNLV basketball during the Jerry Tarkanian era, have had trouble filling the city's arenas. On a recent Friday afternoon, a modest crowd has gathered at the ESPN Zone restaurant in the New York, New York casino. The zone's viewing rooms offer a confusing jumble of 14 different games on a full wall of big-screen TVs. While they eat an early dinner, Jan and Renee Lauer peer into a television embedded in their table.
We're from Detroit. We wanted to come and see the Pistons, so we're here tonight.
Wouldn't miss a game.
No, we haven't missed one yet.
No way.
Renee is dressed to the nines, and she shyly admits that she and Jan are in Las Vegas on their honeymoon thing. But the Lauers would take even more time away from celebrating on the Strip if they could watch their beloved Pistons in person. And they believe others might do the same.
If Las Vegas had a winning team, you'd have plenty of fans because of that. But you've got people here that would follow their home teams here. Yeah. So.
They have a beautiful stadium, I'm sure.
Las Vegas averages 325,000 visitors a day, but tourists alone wouldn't be nearly enough to support a professional team. And what about Las Vegas Valley's 2 million residents, many of whom are transplants whose sports loyalties have already been set? Professor Thompson believes that's the hardest sell of all.
If we had a good NBA team, maybe they could get the crowd. But I'll tell you another thing about the person living in Vegas. We are entertained to death. There's too much going on here. So the competition of an NBA team would be difficult. I don't know if we could get the 15,000 out for every game. I don't know if we could get the 15,000 for, what do they do, 80 baseball games a year. I don't know if we could get that.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Las Vegas.
Could it be? Yes, it could. Something's coming, something good. If I can wait, something's coming. I don't know what it is, but it is gonna be great. With a click, with a shock, phone will jingle, door will knock. Open the latch, something's coming. Don't know when, but it's soon. Catch the moon, one-handed catch.
You can listen at your leisure to programs past and present on our website, onlyagame.org.
Whistling down the river, come on, deliver to me.
You're listening to Only a Game. 5 years ago this weekend, Dale Earnhardt, an iconic figure among NASCAR racing fans, crashed his car into the wall at the Daytona 500 and died. In an article that will appear in the New York Times Magazine tomorrow, Stephen Dubner and Stephen Levitt make an intriguing case for NASCAR racing in general and Dale Earnhardt's crash in particular as engines driving safety and survival at the track. The argument runs that Earnhardt's accident, which was the seventh fatality within NASCAR's three major divisions in 7 years, encouraged the development of, among other things, safer head and neck restraints and safer walls for drivers to slam into. I'm not being facetious in that characterization of the walls. Crashing into walls is apparently always going to be part of the deal in NASCAR. Dubner and Levitt point out that last year's Nextel Cup races involved 345 crashes, an all-time high, and that the number of crashes overall is actually up a bit since Earnhardt died. But the number of fatalities since then stands at a thoroughly acceptable zero. Part of Dubner and Levitt's argument is that auto racing fans are thrilled by crashes but prefer wrecks that don't kill anybody. Hence the development of the spectacular non-fatal accident. Unhappily, the article is not ambitious enough to try to empirically establish the mindset of NASCAR fans. The authors conclude that NASCAR fans love crashes from the evidence that the edited replays of races on TV feature a lot of them. Then Dubner and Levitt fearlessly conclude that NASCAR's newest rules have been designed to, quote, maintain the delicate and masterful balance it has cultivated. It has enough crashes to satisfy its fans, but not too many to destroy the sport or its drivers. Please note, I, Bill Littlefield, host of Only a Game, am not saying that people attend auto racing events in order to see numbers of their fellow human beings go hurtling into a wall at almost 200 miles an hour. My own limited experience with the phenomenon suggests that camaraderie and alcohol are more compelling motives. Mr. Dubner and Mr. Levitt write that NASCAR fans love crashes the way hockey fans love fights. I don't write that. And I hope they have a very large asbestos-lined email box at the Times. But on this particular Daytona 500 weekend, it's excellent to entertain the possibility that whatever draws fans to the track, and whatever has inspired NASCAR to make changes in the equipment, the tracks, and the rules that govern the competition, Part of Dale Earnhardt's legacy is a decrease in deaths among his former colleagues. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. By the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, Bicon.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, I'm joined by the authors of an unauthorized biography of Bob Knight for an authorized conversation. But first, Charlie Pierce, also an author, is here for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Last week, you identified short track speed skating as your favorite Winter Olympics event. Has that spectacle lived up to your expectations?
It's been terrific, but coming up on the outside is the apparently endless number of things you can do on a snowboard. Snowboard cross is very close to being my favorite sport now, basically because it's a perfect sport to run in the Winter Olympics the same week that the Daytona 500 is going to be run.
Absolutely. And what else have you either enjoyed or deplored among Olympic events and Olympians?
I like the fact that a lot of the American success is coming from a bunch of incredible goofballs. Between the two snowboarding half-pipers, which takes on a whole different meaning in that particular sport, and the late lamented performance of Johnny Weir, who is by far the strangest American athlete since Doc Ellis gave up LSD. I like the fact that we're not, you know, Bodie Miller, with all his commercials and all his magazine covers, isn't the star. The star is a bunch of guys that use like as a punctuation mark, mm-hmm. and wow is their middle name.
How can somebody nicknamed the Flying Tomato be bad?
The other thing I loved about the two snowboard half-pipers is when they had a delay in their sport, what did they do? They went to another mountain and went snowboarding.
How do you suppose the Lords of the Rings are handling the news that more people in the U.S. are watching American Idol than are watching the Olympics?
Well, they're cashing the checks from NBC, so the Lords of the Rings are happy. We may be seeing with these Olympics the last gurgling in an empty tank of the concept of plausibly live. Given the amount of information and the amount of ways to get it in the United States, it's very hard to sell a sporting event where most of your audience already knows what happened.
The 55th NBA All-Star Game is in Houston tomorrow. Will you be catching any of the hoop spectacular, or will you be too worn out by the NBA Skills Challenge, Shooting Stars, Three-Point Shootout, Rookie Game, and Dunk competitions by the time they get around to playing the game?
I don't know. I mean, you talk about, they really have created a weekend out of this thing. The Dunk Contest and the Three-Point Shot Contest have now completely contracted elephantiasis, and we have the Rookie Challenge, the Celebrity Game. We have the practices, which will essentially be another dunk contest. And then we have the basketball game.
Yes, if anybody still has any energy for it. After the All-Star break, the number two pick in the 2003 NBA draft will be in a different uniform. Will seven-footer Darko Milicic develop into the player everybody once thought he could be once he gets to Orlando?
It's a terrible thing for the Pistons. They've finally given up on you know, this is the sort of ill-tasting pastrami in the Carmelo Anthony, LeBron James, Dwayne Wade sandwich. He could possibly turn out to be a very serviceable NBA player, but the Pistons had to cut and run on this one.
Do you see many more trades happening before the deadline next Thursday? And part two of the question is, will New York Knicks president Isaiah Thomas trade the whole team for a bag of Christmas hams and a 1974 El Camino?
That's entirely possible, unless the entire team decides to trade Isaiah Thomas for a general manager and president that knows what he's doing. Actually, intriguingly around here is the fate of Paul Pierce in the Boston Celtics. There's persistent rumors that they're trying to trade him before the deadline, maybe even to the Minnesota Timberwolves for Kevin Garnett, which would give you the reunion of Kevin Garnett and Wally Szczerbiak on the Celtics, and they still don't like each other. So that would be a wonderful thing to move the entire crisis of the Minnesota Timberwolves east to the TD Bank North Garden.
Elsewhere in pro basketball, it looks as if Jim O'Brien, formerly the coach at Ohio State, is about to become a very wealthy man, even by the standards of Division I basketball coaches. Apparently because although he did something wrong, it wasn't all that wrong. Have I got that right?
Well, a judge has ruled they had been fired improperly, and the casus belli was a $6,000 loan he'd given to a prospect from Serbia O'Brien's argument, which was upheld by the court essentially, was this player in question from Serbia had already forfeited his amateur standing because he played professionally already. O'Brien said he gave the money to the guy's family because the player's father had died. The guy never played for the Buckeyes. And so, as in many things, when NCAA regulations get into an actual court with actual lawyers and an actual law, they fall apart.
It was otherwise a bad week for college basketball coaches, especially for Oklahoma State's Eddie Sutton and Indiana's Mike Davis. What's going on there?
Well, Mike Davis never had a chance. He took the Hoosiers in his second year to the national championship game, and people still made nasty phone calls and wept for the departed Bob Knight. Eddie Sutton was involved in a DUI. This could very well be the end of a 35-year coaching career. Eddie Sutton sort of brought shame upon his university himself, Indiana University, because of its complete inability to back up Mike Davis against some of the lunatics that follow its team, has managed to disgrace itself rather than its coach.
In National Hockey League news, this week investigators said that Wayne Gretzky and his family had no involvement in the multimillion-dollar gambling ring allegedly run by Phoenix Coyotes assistant Rick Tocchet outside of the odd $100,000 bet, and that the great one and his wife did nothing illegal. Is the league breathing a sigh of relief, or is this just one of many bullets it will have to dodge as details of Operation Slapshot become public?
Well, the league is breathing a sigh of relief because Wayne Gretzky, the iconic figure in its last 30 or 40 years, is now out from under the cloud of criminal suspicion. I wonder if there's some sort of deal cut whereby Janet Jones will testify against the other folks in this particular gambling ring. But the NHL, which does not need any bad publicity, is now in for a year or a year and a half of it.
Rufus the Bull Terrier won Best in Show at the Westminster Kennel Club this week, Charlie, apparently because his head was shaped exactly like an egg.
Egg-headed dogs are very big in the Westminster.
Does this mean that among the other 2,621 dogs being judged, there were none who had egg-shaped heads?
Apparently insufficiently egg-shaped head. I wonder, given what we know about Bull Terriers, how his handlers managed to overcome what we in the dog show world like to call the slobber factor.
And finally, Charlie, in the season's final Super Bowl story, I give you Marvin Hackworth of Gillette, Wyoming, who bet $40,000 on the Seahawks, but was apparently determined to be prepared in case they lost.
Yes, apparently he disappeared the day after the Super Bowl rather than pay his bet, and they found him in Chadron, Nebraska, which I'm willing to bet means you cannot use the phrase head for the hills in anything except metaphorical sense. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if in the next room at that motel they found the referees who actually worked the Super Bowl, who are also in hiding at this point.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Sunday Boston Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
As a reserve on the Ohio State basketball team, Bob Knight's most dramatic moment came before a game against Wake Forest in 1962. In an attempt to fire up the crowd, the Demon Deacon, Wake Forest's mascot, had cut into Ohio State's layup line. Bob Knight punched the mascot in the head. From 1971 until 2000, as the coach at Indiana University, Knight was more inclined to kick, grab, choke, scream at, and otherwise humiliate his players than he was to punch them. He was also known to break furniture and throw chairs, all behaviors which might have gotten him fired if his teams hadn't won so many basketball games. Steve Delson and Mark Heisler have written an unauthorized biography of Bob Knight entitled, oddly enough, Bob Knight, the Unauthorized Biography. They join me now from NPR West in Los Angeles. Steve Delson, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having us.
And Mark Heisler, thank you for joining me.
Our pleasure.
One of the themes in your book seems to be that Bob Knight has always believed that the people who say they're behind him and they want him to succeed will ultimately betray him. To what extent do you think that's been a self-fulfilling prophecy?
I think it's been very self-fulfilling. Knight does not respond well to criticism, particularly from his employers. And it's not an uncommon trait amongst coaches at this level. But Knight has a history of these really dramatic rifts with people who were very, very dear to him, you know, from Mike Krzyzewski to some of the assistant coaches who worked for him. If you don't back this guy to the hilt, he sees it as a betrayal.
Knight's greatest weakness, and the reason that he's gotten into all this trouble,
is his inability to learn from anything that ever happened to him. And it's amazing when you take into account that he is an extremely intelligent guy. But his whole life has been about doing it his way and insisting on doing it his way and insisting that everybody else sign off on it no matter what he did.
There's one particularly exceptionally vulgar tirade, locker room tirade, that Knight launched into. There's a tape of it that circulated around for years. And in this particular explosion, the only word more prominent than Knight's favorite four-letter word is the pronoun I. At one point, he told his 1981 team, just get me to the Final Four and I'll win it. To what extent is that kind of egotism representative of coaches in the major programs?
I think it's very representative. But I also think Knight is kind of a classic narcissist. And somebody at Indiana told us that after they won their first championship, you know, his ego, which was already pretty big, took a pretty big leap there. So I don't think he's the only self-absorbed college basketball coach by any means, but it's always been all about Knight.
Every coach has what Knight has and thinks what Knight thinks. The difference between Knight and everybody else is it's completely naked with him. Everybody else is afraid to say these kinds of things. Knight just says them. He cannot live any other way. It's his world. It's always about him.
And there's a lot of coaches that respect him for that. Knight says things publicly. You know, he tells school presidents to, you know, take a walk and rips the media and calls a spade across the board. And a lot of coaches would love to do that, and they don't have the guts. Knight does. And I think some of them get vicarious pleasure out of it and actually admire him for it.
Everywhere Bob Knight has coached, West Point, Indiana, now Texas Tech, he's become a major challenge for the athletic director and the president of the college, or the commandant, whichever may be the case. Did it strike you as remarkable that a basketball coach could take up so much of the time and energy of the people running a university?
Well, one of the things that you really appreciate when you write this book, and if you read this book, is it shows the disproportionate importance, how completely out of control athletics is, and especially a successful athletic team. And even an athletic team at a place like Army, where it's not going to be, it's not like football at Notre Dame or basketball at Duke. But even in that context, there is such a desire to identify with a winner. Winning is extremely important at West Point. There's just really no check. There's very minimal and very limited checks on any successful athletic team and on any successful coach.
One thing that has distinguished Bob Knight from most coaches is that his teams have won more games than their teams have won. How many games might Knight's teams have won if so many players hadn't left his programs because they couldn't stand to be in them?
Well, the most dramatic example of that is Larry Bird.
Exactly.
But it's still debatable whether Bird really left because of Knight or whether he was completely overwhelmed by the size of Indiana University. You know, certainly Knight's teams would have won more games, I think it's fair to say, if some of his key recruits hadn't left. But Knight was never about going out and getting, you know, the top high school players in the nation, stacking his entire roster with those kind of guys. He wanted guys who would play his game, hard workers, intelligent, and, he definitely, even when guys left, you could make the argument that Knight could take his five guys and beat you, and then take the other guy's five guys and still beat you. And that's what we tried to do in the book. We never, ever dodged any controversies. We never wanted this book to be a Valentine, but we always wanted to give this guy his due when he deserved it. And certainly as a coach, this guy was clearly a cut above.
Even more important than the guys who left were the, as Steve suggested, were the guys who never got there in the first place because Knight didn't pursue them. If you look at three big programs, if you look at Indiana, Duke, and North Carolina, from 1981 on, and that's 1981 is when Isaiah Thomas left, Isaiah Thomas being Knight's only NBA All-Star ever, Knight recruited 16 McDonald's All-Americans. In that same time, North Carolina, with about three or four coaches, recruited 31, and Duke recruited 30. Knight almost handicapped himself to see if he could do it his way. Mike Krzyzewski, who was very much his disciple, does it the same way as Knight does, except he does it with players. He does it with every McDonald's All-American he gets in, can get his hands on. That's about three or four a year.
Coach Knight has a reputation for running a clean program. No money under the table, no cars, and certainly he still has lots of supporters in Bloomington and the rest of Indiana. Have his critics failed to see that Bob Knight is as complex a figure as he is?
Yeah, I think it depends on the critic. You know, there's a reason, you know, Knight doesn't like the media, and that is there's a lot of people in the media who aren't very good at what they do, frankly. And so I do think some of Knight's critics have turned him into a cartoon character instead of a complicated flesh-and-blood human being. But I think, you know, for the most part, most people have accepted and recognized that he graduated an unusually large percentage of his players, that he didn't cheat. And, you know, I think what a lot of people don't know about Knight is that once his players leave, you know, the relationship tends to change. Knight has more and closer relationships with a lot of former players than other coaches do who have much better public reputations. You know, Knight will kill you while you're there. But once you leave, if you really need something, several players told us Knight is there, and he's there pretty quickly.
Knight School, a so-called reality show featuring Bob Knight, will premiere tomorrow on ESPN. Can this be a good idea?
Well, obviously, it's a bad idea for ESPN. I think their own ombudsman, George Solomon, recently criticized it with good reason. It's certainly crossing the line between taking a news subject and hiring him and putting him on your staff while he's still a news subject. But, you know, we'll be watching it with great interest, if no one else.
Steve Delson and Mark Heisler are the authors of Bob Knight, the Unauthorized Biography, published by Simon & Schuster. They join me from NPR West in Los Angeles. Steve, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Mark, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. A fond farewell this week to Christine Fischera, whose deft touch has graced our website and whose voice has enhanced our haiku segments for years. Good luck, Christine. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view a speed skating photo gallery, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from 11-year-old speed skater Emily Ott, also a soccer player, who has tried to get her soccer teammates to the speed skating rink.
Yeah, but it doesn't really work. They don't have the guts to come out here.
Yeah, and even if they did at the first sign of contact, they'd be flopping to the ice like sacks of potatoes, pretending to be mortally wounded and begging the ref for a red card. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, continuing support of individual creativity with the announcement of new MacArthur Fellows on September 20th. This is NPR, National.